From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
And I think it's important, as we approach the moment of signing the bill into law, that we remember the words of a man named Paul, who said centuries ago that love is patient, love is kind, love bears all things, love believes all things, love hopes all things, love endures all things, love never fails. And I'm going to sign this bill right now.
You know, I don't want to really get into individual politicians and by name, but one thing that I have said publicly is that if he makes a decision based on his political choices, well, that's his decision. But if he does invoke his faith, well, as the leader of the Catholic faith in this diocese, I would have something to say about that, which I have.
That's Governor Pat Quinn at the beginning, signing the same-sex marriage legislation in Chicago this week. At the same time, there were prayers of exorcism in Springfield from Catholic Bishop Thomas Papraki, and Papraki commenting there on lawmakers and Catholicism. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel on State Week this week, Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Sean Crawford, News Director of WUIS, Amanda Venicky, State House Bureau Chief for WUIS Illinois Public Radio, and Brian Mackey, State House Reporter for WUIS IPR. Well, the same-sex marriage law has been signed. It takes effect in June. It's an issue we've talked a lot about, but there are still a few issues out there worthy of discussion. Real fast, how many bill signings have we had with what? Was there a couple thousand people watching that bill signing?
That's the estimate that I saw. Yeah, it was at the UIC Forum in Chicago. A couple thousand people were there. They had a choir, lots of cheering, many, many politicians. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, Governor Pat Quinn, Republican Controller Judy Bartopinka was there. Lots of state lawmakers and sort of a raucous party atmosphere. Yeah, I mean, Charlie, maybe you can think back in your memory, but I can't think of another bill signing with literally thousands of people in attendance.
Yeah, I can't either. This is, obviously, it's a once-in-a-lifetime event, and it was staged like a huge political rally. And as you say, the estimates, I wasn't there, obviously, but the estimates were well over 1,000 people there to watch this historic occasion. And I don't recall that for any other bill.
A huge political rally, and just coincidentally, Governor Pat Quinn is running for re-election, so...
Now, we had some comments in there from the bishop, the Springfield Diocese, Mr. Papraki. Can you illuminate us a little more context on what those were?
Yeah, so this is last week. The bishop, while he was at the Conference of Catholic Bishops in Baltimore, this Thomas Papraki is the bishop of Springfield, the Roman Catholic diocese in Springfield, which covers, I think, 38 counties in central Illinois. He put out this release saying he was going to have prayers of supplication and exorcism in reparation for the sin of same-sex marriage. Now, a lot of people immediately saw the word exorcism, and as the bishop pointed out in his remarks at the service, people think of Hollywood movies when that comes out, and, you know, pea soup and all the kind of sensationalistic things. He said this is not what this was. There's actually an exorcism, he says, in every Catholic baptism. You know, do you reject Satan is part of the standard litany of text. And that's the sort of thing that he was doing here. Not that there is any individual person in sort of a demonic possession, but, you know, just this idea of a diabolical influence on our society as he sees it. I think it's worth, you know, there have been some criticism. Well, this guy's just looking for publicity, and, you know, making a name for himself. But I do think that it's worth considering because he does represent, you know, some significant portion of the population that is very unsettled by this idea of same-sex marriage. The service itself turned out to be, I attended it. It was an hour-long prayer service. A lot of it was conducted in Latin. I found it interesting, and it was pretty tame. He was almost dispassionate as he read these prayers. So certainly an interesting, one of the more interesting things I've ever covered.
And as we look at same-sex marriage, one of the issues has been that they've been talking about the impact of business. What's that debate been about, Amanda Vinicky?
Well, you know, you just have a lot of questions in terms of what practical effect this will have. The opponents had said that they were very against the notion of same-sex marriage, despite the religious protections that were put in place, because they say that there have been situations in other states, or even there is an ongoing legal battle regarding a bed and breakfast in Illinois that turned away a same-sex couple who wanted to engage in a civil union. So a question when it comes to the outlay of this, will, for example, a wedding planner be able to reject customers that are, gay men or lesbian women that want the wedding planner services? And what will that mean? So an expectation that there could be some lawsuits or some legal ramifications here. You talk to the people who wrote the same-sex marriage law, and they say that that is basic civil rights protections that have long been passed and that private businesses should not deny those individuals. But those are the sort of things that you're already hearing from organizations such as the Thomas More Society, saying that, no, their fight's not over yet. They continue to have hopes that the courts will intervene, and they fear that there will be religious individuals that will be persecuted. Fine if churches and synagogues won't have to, for example, perform marriages between same-sex couples, but it is something that is very much going to, I think, play out. On the opposite side, the business angle would be that there are those who say that this is going to be a great draw for Illinois' economy, that there will no longer be people fleeing the state. I mean, I know individuals that have left and gotten married in other states and, you know, taken all of the hubbub and the massive dollars that go with a wedding with them when they do so, and instead that maybe same-sex couples will choose to marry in the state of Illinois and pay for a whole lot of things while they're doing it.
Well, it occurs to me that this concern that if you're for religious reasons, you don't want to have to deal with people who are homosexual. That issue, in terms of people who offer services to the public, was addressed and kind of put to rest about 10 years ago, as Amanda mentioned, when the state made discrimination based on sexual orientation one of the practices that are against the law. You can't discriminate against people based on their age, based on their race, based on their ethnic origin, based on their gender. And as I say, roughly 10 years ago, the legislature passed, and I believe it was Governor Blagojevich signed, a law adding sexual orientation to the list of things that can't be legitimate grounds for discrimination. So if I'm a wedding planner and I say, well, I don't want to participate because this couple is same sex, that's already banned. And it was banned, long before the gay marriage legislation was actually signed into law.
Exactly. Something that 10 years ago, not that anybody hadn't thought about gay marriage, but was certainly nobody, I think, expected at the time that it would move so quickly, gain such momentum, and come into play in such, this is kind of an obvious way that will come to fruition for a business owner.
Well, and it seems so odd to look back at that, because at the time that was such a controversial piece of legislation. And now we look back at that, and I think most people think, well, yeah, you shouldn't discriminate based on sexual orientation. It doesn't mean you're in favor of same-sex marriage. Certainly people have different views on that. But it just seems such an antiquated thought back then when you look back on it. It was only, like Charlie said, about a decade ago, and here we are now. I mean, it just shows you, I think, the change in the public's mind And it's pretty dramatic when you look at what's happened over just this last few years.
I think more specifically, it was a change in the control of the Senate. The Senate went from Republican control and being headed by a Senate president named James Pate Phillip, who was very much against this idea of adding sexual orientation to the list of discriminations. And then when the Democrats became the majority, the bill sailed through the Senate.
And it is worth noting, though, Sean, I mean, you point out that this is something that we just kind of take for granted in Illinois now. But in Congress, in Washington, at this very moment, they're considering something called the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And there's, you know, some question about whether this can pass. And this would basically create a federal protection employment, you know, against employment discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation.
Well, and I think even legislators that were in favor of that 2005 law now don't necessarily like how it's playing out. I've spoken with legislators that voted against same-sex marriage in Illinois, citing their fears about what it would mean for private businesses. So the connect may be there in the law, but perhaps not in people's minds.
You're listening to State Week. Just ahead, the unions start gearing up for opposition to a pension proposal that could soon be emerging.
Support for State Week in Review comes from the Illinois State Bar Association, whose activities include proposing and shaping legislation, educating the public, and supporting the courts and the rule of law. Information at IllinoisLawyerFinder.com.
Our panel on State Week, Sean Crawford, Charlie Wheeler, Amanda Venicky, and Brian Mackey. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Well, is a pension overhaul appears to be coming together with legislative leaders. Unions, who say they've seen it, say they don't like what's in it, and they're planning to get their members to contact lawmakers. So where are we, State House, on the pension issue right now? Does it look like Illinois legislators will be back in early December to take up an issue that legislative leaders appear to be close on?
You know, I would be surprised if they don't come back. That date has just been so out there publicly. And, of course, leaders need to send a memo, get in touch with their members to make sure that a date is reserved. That said, there are back avenue channels that they could use if they weren't planning on. And, of course, the timing is very auspicious. It is the day after the filing deadline. So all legislators would be returning to Springfield knowing who their primary opponent, if any, would be. There's no deal set yet. The legislative leaders have continued to meet. They will meet again next week. No date is certain for that. I spoke with, you know, three of the spokespeople for the various caucuses who all say that progress was made. That's the same line that we have been getting, but they are kind of nailing in and they continue to hone in on what the main issue is. And again, however, that's been the same issue for a matter of weeks now, and that is how to structure the cost of living increases that will be part of a final plan. From what I've been able to gather from the legislative leaders, they really are no closer in terms of what to do about that. That's where the argument, the questions, the debate continues to lie.
In the eyes of the unions, who are certainly getting their opposition organized already, they sense that this measure will lean more to the Speaker Madigan type of legislation than the Senator John Cullerton legislation of the two competing versions that were out there that have passed a chamber in one respect or another.
And, you know, that has been the criticism from the part of, for example, some Senate Democrats that favored the original Cullerton method of what the conference committee had come up with, and part of why the conference committee didn't come forward with any sort of final report, because you had legislators who were, you know, affiliated with unions or who are more sensitive to any cuts that would be made to retirees and state workers' benefits that said that they didn't think the conference committee's portion went far enough, and what the leaders are looking at is very closely aligned to what the conference committee had come up with. So unions have really not liked anything other than the plan that they negotiated with Senate President Cullerton. So I don't think it's surprising that they are coming out against this. This definitely would do things such as give them, you know, a lower cost of living adjustment, something that they hadn't wanted. They don't think that it does the same consideration or kind of making a trade for getting something in exchange for giving something up.
And I would say that's a key point, because the Senate President, John Cullerton, has really insisted all along. Through he had his top lawyer, Eric Medeer, did a lot of research, produced a 70-something page paper on this, and he's very wrapped up in this idea that you have to give people something if you're taking something away under contract law. And that's not even necessarily even getting to the part of the Illinois Constitution that says pension benefits shall not be diminished, but just as a principle of contract law, we're going to take some of your benefits away. We have to give you something in return. And so,
and this plan does, it would be give, for example, employees would have to contribute less to their pension benefits. But unions are saying that that's not enough. That's not enough of a deal.
Is taking 8% instead of 9% or whatever it would be in your individual case in exchange for, you know, depriving me of tens of thousands of dollars after I, you know, that I might otherwise get after I retire. Is that a good enough deal?
And I would say, too, that it can't be imposed unilaterally, in that the other party to the contract has to agree to it.
This is called offer and acceptance in contract law, right?
You have to accept it. Well, I'm not a lawyer, but yeah. And it's interesting. Everybody focuses on the unions. Well, as a matter of fact, all of us on this program are employees of the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. None of us are unionized. We're all in the state university retirement system. And so whatever ASC me might say it's agreeable to for its members who are state workers, that doesn't bind me or any of us in any way, shape, or form.
No, everybody pays attention to unions because they're the ones that have the dollars that they contribute to candidates, and that's why legislators are so vested in what unions think, and unions have the money to ostensibly, you know, file a lawsuit. They hold a lot of power here. I think where they stand is important, and right now we're talking about what has gone down from a conference committee proposal and now to the four legislative leaders, and there hasn't been a lot of involvement to this point with rank and file members. And again, there is no defined plan there. What to do with cost of living adjustments is still being decided by the leaders. That said, it appears as if rank and file members are going to begin to learn more about this proposal, or at least be talked to about where they stand on it. And oftentimes where the legislative
and you're talking about rank and file lawmakers here, not rank and file union members.
Oh, yes. Pardon me. Yes. Legislators. Yes. And so, I mean, in generally where the legislative leaders stand, the rank and file will eventually follow. That said, on something like this, kind of like same-sex marriage, as we talked about, there are some issues where you take orders from your leader. There are others where candidates that are looking to, you know, win campaigns or have allegiances, geographic or otherwise, to, for example, a union standpoint, may not be willing to go along with it. Lots of legislators on either side who say either this goes too far or doesn't go far enough in bringing down the state's unfunded liability. So that's really going to be key.
And let's not forget their own self-interest. I mean, lawmakers are a member of a pension system as well. And a lot of them, you know, a lot of them are lawyers and have other, you know, a lot of money in their pocket. But for some of them, this is their main job. And, you know, they would be taking a vote not just to, you know, anger the unions and perhaps anger a lot of state employees by doing this, but also reducing their own pension benefits.
And it would seem odd that they would come back without not only maybe a plan to vote on, but also possibly some type of structured roll call, at least behind the scenes that they've worked out. It would seem odd to me that they would do that. I mean, I would guess that they want a certain number of Republicans, a certain number of Democrats in each chamber to go on this. We know that some people, like you said, Amanda, cannot vote for this because they represent maybe a large number of state workers. So is there that talk going on behind the scenes as well?
You know, it seems to be, like you said, Sean, it would be strange for the legislature to come back without something preordained, because it would bring a whole lot of attention to just how big of a mess things are. That said, I who knows what political calculations could possibly be going on, if that would provide any sort of cover. Hey, look, we tried, we did this, we got close, play the blame game. There's also, I think, a lot of hope that for the horse racing industry that has come to a deal regarding advanced deposit wagering that's kind of complicated to get into, but they need a vote and they need it quick. So they're really, they're riding on the legislature coming back for this General Assembly. That's what we're going to hear about, I think, now leading up to December 3rd. As I said, this is when the legislative leaders say that they're going to really begin speaking with the rank and file members of their caucuses, and we'll be able to better glean if there is enough support. And that's when I think we'll see whether or not they're actually going to come back that first week in December or not. No decision made yet.
And now the union, their stance is if it's not the item we negotiated, we're against it. And that's what they're starting to send out to their members, because that's what is the message they want members to start notifying legislators. They start this effort as it approaches a holiday. That could quell some of the interest. And if lawmakers do come back at that early December date, they may act quickly. Charlie, do you think the union has a chance at getting successful lobbying from the grassroots done at this point?
Yeah, I think they do, because if you think about it, for example, every district in the state of Illinois, every legislative district has teachers in it. All the teachers in Illinois are unionized. They belong either to the Illinois Education Association or the Illinois Federation of Teachers. And so I can see at family gatherings over Thanksgiving, somebody's grandma or somebody's aunt who's a retired teacher who speaks out and says, you know, this is really going to hurt me. It's going to cost me tens of thousands of dollars in my retirement, what they're talking about in Springfield, cutting benefits for retirees by $150 billion or whatever the number is. And I need you to call your local legislature and say you don't want that to happen to your dear old aunt or whatever. So I can see this being an issue. And I think the unions are going to go all out to block the kind of plan that, from their perspective, is having a draconian effect on their membership.
Another issue that we follow from the Illinois Capitol is spending on political campaigns and donations to those political campaigns. Bruce Rauner, one of the Republican candidates, picked up a nice chunk of change from a donor this past week, Amanda Winicky.
He's a couple of them. So Bruce Rauner, as we have previously mentioned, lifted Illinois' new campaign finance cap. So this would have been the first time in a statewide race that there would have been limits on campaign contributions. Instead, Rauner, who is a very wealthy venture capitalist, has been pouring his own funds that lifted the cap for all of the candidates during the primary. And Rauner so far has really seen the benefit of it. Twice in 1 week, he had two donors, each giving a quarter of $1 million to his campaign. These aren't obviously no slouches if they have that much money to give to a politician.
Or they're tremendous slouches, as the old joke.
Yeah, there you go. there are some heavyweights in the business world. So the former CEO of Allscripts Healthcare, Glenn Tolman, and then also Ken Griffin, who Forbes has crowned the wealthiest man in Illinois, more so even than Sam Zell. Griffin heading Citadel Investments. So Griffin and Tolman, interestingly, both have previously given to Democrats. And that's something that there appears to be some criticism in terms of, hey, is that going to hurt Rauner?
And Rauner has had his own contributions to
exactly.
Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, which, you know, I'm sure that some of his opponents are looking forward to, you know, if they can get some of the money that he's going to have to try and, you know, if he doesn't buy up all the ad airtime on TV to run some ads
against
him.
That's the thing. He's drowning out all of his Republican opponents completely. There's clearly a lot of excitement in terms of the wealthy business men and women of the world behind Bruce Rauner, and he's going to drown them out. It will remain to be seen if all of those big dollar contributions in any way, you know, backfire, either because of those ties to Democrats maybe, or even just that this is a wealthy, out-of-touch guy who's got wealthy, out-of-touch contributors. Rauner trying to defeat that in his ads that he has been running, you know, wearing jeans and hunting jacket and that sort of thing. So trying to portray himself in
I believe
touch.
It's called a barn coat. I don't often get to correct barn Amanda coat. On there fashion. But yeah, and he points to his cheap watch. And this is my favorite detail, not to pile on, but at the State Fair, he did have a red bandana placed on his back pocket, sticking out just so. So the man is clearly paying attention to his image, I think, and is really making a point of trying to portray himself not as the gazillionaire that he is, but as the, you know, the man who is going to come in and shake up Springfield, as he puts it.
A little close to Dan Walker, isn't it, Charlie?
That's exactly what I was going to say, Bill, that red bandana. Now, all that Mr. Rauner needs is to kind of walk the state from the Ohio River up to the Wisconsin border with a pair of jeans and a blue work shirt and a red bandana. And Walker did it to kind of create an image of this rural populist sort of individual as opposed to a corporate lawyer, which is what he was. And he was also an outsider. He was going to come in and reform things. And we all know how well that went. So
I just can't reemphasize enough, I mean, how much money this is. We talk a lot of money in all of these races that continue, more and more continues to be spent. But Rauner, in a matter of days, has raised more than any of his opponents have in a year's time. And this is just the beginning. This is literally just about a week after the cap was lifted.
And I think it's fascinating to look at, you know, he sends these emails, and as somebody who has never given, I don't think, to a political campaign, you know, he sends these, but I am on his list, so I get his solicitations, and he says, can you support our campaign with a donation of $10, $25, or $50? And you think, for a lot of people, that's a stretch, but maybe they do it. They like his message. They like what he has to say. But then how does that feel when somebody else just gives him $250,000. You think, boy, I could have used that $10 to have dinner this weekend or something. Does he really need my help?
Well, I get some of those solicitation letters too, because I'm on some of these people's lists. But I get ones from some Democratic candidates that says, "Could you spare $3?" Yeah. So I guess it's all in your perspective.
And that, you know, this President Obama did so well with these small donors, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I could use $250,000. I guess I could word it that way.
Sure.
But think about that. $250,000 is probably, I'm guessing it's probably five times the median annual income of a resident of Illinois. And here's somebody who drops that amount of money onto a politician. It just boggles the mind of me, and I'm sure that it would confound other folks too.
And again, it's just starting. It's not even at the point where this is, you know, down to the wire a race, and that could tip the edge. We're really in the beginning early stages. Yeah, he isn't even an official candidate yet because filing begins on Monday.
And right now, with the Republicans, it looks like it'll be a four-way primary. Of course, there could always be other candidates that file in the coming week and a half. We have just about a minute left. I'll throw it to Amanda Venicky for a note from the field.
Well, something that will preserve the life of Illinois' coal-fired power plants for better if you come from the perspective of the local towns where they're big employers. For worse, if you're coming at it from an environmental standpoint, the Illinois Pollution Control Board getting probably the most attention it's gotten in years by granting basically a waiver that says Dynegy does not have to comply with Illinois' pollution control standards that if it is going to purchase power plants from Ameren. So that's big news in both the energy markets and, again, in the environmental world.
That's our time for this edition of State Week. You can get a podcast of this show by going to WUIS.org, or if using a desktop or laptop, find it on iTunes by searching for State Week in Review. Production assistance for our program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.